All right, so now we are going to change tack a little bit and move over to Dennis to talk about sale and leaseback transactions. So this is agenda paper 4. Dennis, I'll hand over to you.
Thanks. Thanks, Sue. Good day, committee members. I'm pleased to introduce agenda paper 4. So in November 2020, the ISB published the exposure draft, a lease liability and a sale and leaseback, to address subsequent measurement of the lease liability that arises in a sale and leaseback transaction. We plan to bring a paper to a future board meeting analyzing feedback we received and providing recommendations on the project direction. So we're not asking the committee to make any decisions in this discussion. To help us develop the project direction and to provide input to the board, we are asking the committee members for your views on the possible ways forward. So for this purpose, the paper summarizes the proposed amendments. It summarizes comments and input received from respondents, and it outlines our preliminary views about the possible project direction. Maybe to help when developing the preliminary views discussed in the paper, we thought through three steps. Step one, paragraphs 22 to 23 in the paper explain what we call the project boundary within which the possible ways forward have been developed. Now, in the exposure draft, the board proposed no change to the initial measurement requirements for sale and leaseback transactions that's already contained in IFRS 16. So the exposure draft did not remove existing differences in the initial measurement of a right-of-use asset and lease liability that arise from a sale and leaseback transaction and the measurement of those assets and liabilities unrelated to such transactions. All right, so this boundary then led us to step two. And in our current view, we then thought about the nature of the possible ways forward, and that is outlined in paragraph 24 of the paper. We believe any solution would be an interim solution to fill the gap, if I may say, in the current sale and leaseback requirements. Now, paragraph 34 in the paper, I think best explains this gap, and it poses it as a question. And it states how to subsequently measure the liability that arises at the date of the sale and leaseback transaction when the amount of that liability on initial recognition differs from the initial measurement of other lease liabilities. Then as step three, we develop possible ways forward for this interim solution, but we approached it from two sides. On the one side, we thought of developing mechanics for the subsequent measurement of the leaseback liability. And then on the other side, we considered perhaps the population of sale and leaseback transactions to which those mechanics would apply. Now, these two sides are then outlined in paragraphs 25 to 33 and paragraphs 34 to 41 in the paper, respectively. As you may note, we do explain in Appendix B the two main alternative solutions for subsequent measurement that were suggested by respondents in their comment letters. We refer to those as the componentized liability approach and the deferred gain approach. All right, but I guess with that, I will direct your attention then to the questions on page 19 of the paper and ask the committee members for their views on a possible project direction. Thank you, Sue.
Okay, so following on from the direction request, do you want to direct me? Would you prefer that the comments are sort of split into, you know, the expected versus imputed payments and then scope, or are you happy just to take all comments together?
Happy with all comments together if right. People feel comfortable with that. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Ducky. All right, so who would like to start with your thoughts to help guide us?
I think Donna was the first in your queue, Sue.
Oh, if I could see the queue, that would be wonderful. And now I can see the queue. All right, Donna, that awesome. Would be wonderful. If you'd like
awesome.
To
Awesome, thanks. Lovely, thank you. So Dennis, first of all, thank you very much. This was an incredibly detailed paper. I have to say is that you certainly did make me think very, very hard over the weekend. You owe me a beer the next time I'm in London. And I do think, though, that it does bring some really, really interesting challenges that have been brought to the board about this matter, especially in light of the fact that under IFRS 9, and I think that's kind of where, obviously, I have an affiliation with IFRS 9 and where I live in the world of accounting, and the whole concept that your lease liability is a debt instrument, not under 9, but mimics like a debt instrument. So therefore, you immediately have this tendency to want to think a little bit in the IFRS 9 world and say, well, under IFRS 9, what would you be doing? So I'm going to be honest with you, from the two perspectives, I didn't really like either, but that's probably because the purist IFRS 9 in me is not liking this concept of where you've, on the one side, you've got the expectation and then you unwind the expectation, and the difference between the expectation and the actual physical cash flow is then seen as an additional lease payment that comes through. In the world of IFRS 9, we would, if we were to have done this and said, these are our expected future cash flows, and we would have then gone back and said, our expected future cash flows are changing, we would then have done a modification or a change, we would have done a change in estimate, which normally goes through interest income or interest expense, to do that kind of cumulative catch-up. Now, I know we're not in 9, I know we're in 16, and therefore we're defined by very different things. First things first is obviously you're looking at variable cash flows that are very akin to an executory contract, because these variabilities relate to profit that the company is going to make or turnover the company is going to make, which means that both parties need to perform, not the parties in the sale and lease back, but the customer and the party to the contract to be able to generate revenue, for example. So there are some complexities in there that you wouldn't necessarily see within the world of IFRS 9, for example. So from my perspective, I think the expected payment approach probably is the one that is the most palatable, I would imagine, from my perspective. I do appreciate that we wouldn't be seeing these transactions on a regular basis, and therefore being able to make very specific assumptions about expectation of revenue. And as from a deal maker's perspective, you wouldn't want to go into a deal like this unless you are very reasonably certain of what type of revenue the company that you're leasing, you've bought the asset from and are leasing back to, will be able to generate sufficient revenue that you'll be able to get a decent written return on your investment, for example. So I do appreciate that we're looking at rather a very limited situation where you'd have to manage the expectation on an individual contract or by contract basis. However, I still am erring a little bit on the side of this discomfort of saying the difference between the expectation that we raise the lease liability and the actual is just a simple expense, an additional income and expense that will go through the income statement. I think that doesn't feel quite right for me. I'm saying if I'm in the world of expected future cash flows, then I need to be in the world of expected future cash flows. And therefore, the change and the difference between actual and expected is actually a change in the rate or a change in the expected future interest that I earn on this instrument, and therefore should be interest, not necessarily this additional variable lease premium that the expected approach actually recommends. I didn't like the imputed payment model in any shape or form, because we're assuming initially we're taking an expectation, and maybe Dennis, you need to correct me here, is that we're taking an expectation of what the future profits are going to be, but then we essentially smooth it for the calculation. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Agreed. Yes.
Okay.
Assuming an equal fixed payment for every period.
Profile. Okay. Yeah. All right. Again, I must admit, it's adding a level of complexity to something that's already complex. So you're basically saying, oh, by the way, you're going to need to estimate what we think your future revenue is going to be. But that's only just to calculate on initial recognition.
But it's not. You need to work out what even payment over time discounted at the rate that 16 uses.
PVs
to the liability. So it's not that complicated.
Yes. No, what I'm saying is it's not complicated, but what I'm saying is you're adding another step. So I think, and what's my experience, what's some, just probably just some experience, my personal experience in is that the more steps you add into the process, the more likely it is that people miss it or misinterpret it or make a mistake. So when I'm saying complexity, I'm just adding not complexity from a calculation perspective, but just it's another thing you need to be cognizant of in the calculation. So I have to admit, I wasn't, but then again, my IFRS 9 is coming through very strongly on this one, and hence the reason why the expected payment approach is probably the way I would go. I do want to kind of would make the suggestion is that I would prefer if the board, whichever approach they go, make it very explicit that this cannot be used as an analogy anywhere else in IFRS. And I'll tell you why, because what concerns me sometimes is that if we're unsure, we do have a tendency to go look at other standards to understand or to unpack a principle. This, in my mind, I don't even know if I could say this is a principle, Dennis. So, I mean, from my perspective, I would be concerned. It's like, We're ramming a square peg into a very round hole, we're trying to create a little bit of a framework to get this to work. Is kind of how I'm envisioning this is, and I'm just concerned that we need to make it. I would like the board to make it very clear that this is very bespoke, very specific, and cannot be used as an analogy to something else in the standards. And I think I think I would feel a little bit better about that. And then the last observations, have we thought, do you think there's going to be an impact from the lessor's perspective on the accounting? Because you would just see it as a normal variable payment, and therefore you would just basically, so it definitely won't be symmetrical. Yeah. Okay. All right. I think obviously from a group conglomerate perspective, that can cause massive pain for some of us, because we would then have disjointed accounting between one sub and another sub if that were to happen in a group scenario. But I mean, I'm hoping that, like you've indicated, this is not going to be something that happens on a regular basis, and therefore we'd be able to manage it, you know, on a one-to-one. So those are my comments. But again, Dennis, thank you very much. It really was a very well put together paper, and the whole team that worked on it and the thinking that's gone behind it. But definitely between a rock and a hard place on this one. This is not clear cut in any shape or form.
Can I ask you a question, Donna, just to make sure I understood your comments? So going back to your comments about expected payments, are you saying that you support using a model that's based on expected payments, but you'd go a step further and require some form of remeasurement when expectations change? So is your comment conditional on it being so it's not actually the expected payments as set out in the paper, it's something closer to an IFRS 9 thinking?
But that's just because I have a little bit of a bias to IFRS 9. So if I'm going to use expected future cash flows, I would say, well, I've already got a principle when I've got expectation of future cash flows or set future cash flows, there's other guidance and other principle that's established in another standard, and I would have said you should then follow something that at least you've got some principle based. But if we're using the argument that, listen, these are an opportunity to try and mitigate a specific scenario, then but I would err more on, if I'm going to be expected, I would then want to say that if there's a change in that expected future cash flow, it would have be a B95, what's a B945 kind of scenario in IFRS 9.
I'm only quizzing you to get maximum bang for my buck in terms of your thinking for our thinking.
And if it's helpful, by the way, I'll only add on that point that obviously, Donna, I mean, just to let you know that when the board put out the ED, it wasn't that they were thinking not requiring remeasurement. There was any great principle behind that. The thought was, in asking people to do, what effectively is described in this paper as, or proposing the expected lease payments approach, it was simply a cost. Cost or benefit call to say that they proposed not to require remeasurement.
It's most similar to what's already in 16.
I think that was the call we took, that across lease liabilities in 16 there are various simplified measurement requirements already in the standard. So I think
that's in mind.
We thought we wouldn't sort of require people to come along and remeasure all the time.
Understand. Thank you very much for that clarification.
Thank you. Sophie.
Yes, first I believe that the product needed, even if I understand that these kind of transactions are maybe not so common for the time being, I believe that it is useful because when this transaction occurs could be potentially very material and concern large amounts. And also, maybe the frequency could increase in the near future. And furthermore, specifying the accounting treatment will reduce the risk of structuring transactions. So what should be the accounting treatment? In fact, between the different accounting approaches that are presented, I am in favor of the expected payment approach. Why? Because it reflects, I believe, the best the economy of the transactions, both on the balance sheet and in P&L. On the balance sheet, because the look-back liability will represent the present value of expected payments at any time over the duration of the lease back, which is a useful information. And also, the treatment in P&L is more relevant as the total net P&L impact will show a degressive effect, which is more economic, in my view, and consistent with the degressive effect that we can see on lease with fixed payments. I agree also with the treatment of the actuals versus expected payments directly in P&L. I agree also with Danny comments on normally it should be more economic and relevant to have a remeasurement, but because of the practical aspects, I agree that we need to find a simpler treatment. So having said that, I am also aware and therefore very concerned by the inconsistency that it will create with the treatment of variable payments on simple lease. I believe that in balance, this inconsistency should not avoid to specify an appropriate treatment for these sales and lease back transactions with variable payments.
Thank you, Sophie. Jens?
Thank you so much. If you allow, I would like to structure my reply a little bit and would start with the second question rather than with question A. So first question I would like to address is whether I support reducing the population of applicable sale and leaseback transactions. And I must confess, I agree that we need to fill a gap. And when I remember our discussion we had initially when this issue was first raised, it was about sale and leaseback transactions where the lease payments are linked to future performance or usage. And I do think this is really the issue that needs to be addressed. And therefore, I would propose reducing the population of applicable sale and leaseback transactions to sale and leaseback transactions where the lease payments are linked to future sales or performance or future usage or performance. I do think this would address the major concerns that we had as a committee when we initially discussed this issue. And honestly, I would say, when I agree with Donny that that you might think of IFRS 9 and before entering into the scope of IFRS 16, one usually would start in IFRS 9 looking for an embedded derivative. And when the underlying is not specific to a party of the contract, we would first need to check whether there is an embedded derivative that needs to be accounted for. And then only when we come to the conclusion that there's not an embedded derivative, we would go into IFRS 16. And then I would specifically address the transactions that we had in mind when initially the issue was raised. And I personally don't think that when there are lease payments that are linked to an index or rate that are subject to remeasurement, I don't think that this is an issue that is prevalent in practice. So I think it's really an issue for payments that are linked to performance or future use. And thus I would propose to reduce the scope for these kinds of sale and leaseback transactions. And with leaving the scope area, I'm happy to address the first question. So question in A, I agree that we need to fill a gap here, but the gap, albeit there is a gap, should be addressed from a principal perspective. And principally speaking, I do think that the expected payment approach is the is the soundest one. So this is a sound answer that if you address it for initial measurement, the expected payments. However, I disagree with the proposed subsequent measurement, especially that there is no real measurement going forward, because I do think that the disconnect between expected and actual payments could be material going forward. And with this, I also disagree with the notion that we should, or the amendment should consider a cost-benefit argument. I do not agree with a cost-benefit argument for IFRS 16, because if there is no material deviation between actual and expected payments, usually we would not see huge remeasurements in practice. But however, if there is a material disconnect between actual and expected payments, then the cost-benefit argument cannot apply, from my understanding. So therefore, I would urge to go forward with the expected payments approach and rethink whether you could require then to be in line with, I think, what Donny just said, to require a request the B546 approach for the lease liability and decouple subsequent measurement of the lease liability, which would then be for this specific sale and leaseback transaction, which are scoped specifically in IFRS 16, that the lease liability is subject to the measurement principle of IFRS 9 and the right of use asset is subject to the subsequent measurement guidance in IFRS 16. So this would be my proposal to have a principle-based solution for this kind of transactions. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question on your scope comments? Sorry, I'm butting in when the staff might have questions. On your scope comments, so in IFRS 16 at the moment, if I remember correctly, the scope that we've already got that we could anchor things on, for want of a better word, might be variable lease payments, excluding those linked to an index or a rate. Would you be comfortable to use that, or are you actually thinking that we would need to come up with a new specific subpopulation that's somehow focusing in on being linked to usage?
No, this would perfectly fit my understanding. I think this addresses my concerns, because I do think, first of all, you would look to IFRS 9 whether there is an embedded derivative. This would be my first step in any place. And then I would go into the scoping of IFRS 16, and then I agree that this would address my concerns, because I don't think that if you have a linkage to a rate or index, that we do need to have additional guidance in IFRS 16, because I do think principally the sale and leaseback transaction model works. It's not broken. It's just these kind of transactions that are in a gap right now.
And then if I could, on the expected payments, I'm sort of with you from a conceptual perspective in terms of the superiority of, you know, coming up with a schedule of expected lease payments, and one would sort of guess that people entering into these transactions should have gone through that sort of thinking to determine the price that they paid, etc., and whether they were happy to do the deal. But I think the reason why the imputed payments is being considered, one of the reasons, is because it takes away some of the complexity of coming up with the expectations, including the complexity of having to think about when particular payments, like the pattern of the expected payments as well. So even though the imputed payments is a bit of a construct, if you like, it's a little bit artificial, it is anchored in the sort of starting value and the discount rate, but then it's like a mortgage repayment profile. It was, I think, designed to help with simplifying that expectation aspect, wasn't it? But you, despite that, you think that it would be better to go with the expected approach?
Yeah, I'm not convinced that the parties subject to a lease do not have some ideas of how the payment profile definitely would look like. So this would be really surprising for me if there is a lessee and a lessor agreeing on, we're talking about big ticket leases. Otherwise, it would not be material, so we wouldn't talk about car leases here. So if we have a big ticket lease, and I would surprise if lessee and lessor enter into agreement without any idea on payment profile and amount of payments. So thus, I'm not convinced that there really is such kind of difficulty to come up with an expected payment profile. Because we're talking about big numbers here, right? And I do think for big numbers, there must be something like a planning or budgeting process behind. Otherwise, they wouldn't agree on this kind of type of contract.
Yep. Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Carsten, I think you were next.
Yeah, thank you. So So first of all, I think this paper is really helpful, especially the examples and related journal entries are really useful, I think, to illustrate and think through alternative approaches. My sense is that the approach proposed in the exposure draft has its merits conceptually, but I do agree with respondents that the approach is quite a complex one to solve a relatively simple issue, which is essentially to limit gain recognition in a sales bag. So I agree with many respondents that, you know, that a simpler approach could be chosen to achieve the desired objective, especially considering that this is intended as an interim solution pending the IFRS 16 PIR. So let's start with the two approaches proposed by the staff. In this regard, I'm not convinced that the imputed payments approach would be much of an improvement, as it wouldn't resolve many of the complexities, I think, that, you know, that have been criticized by respondents. So I would not recommend the imputed payments approach. So out of the two approaches suggested by the staff, I would definitely be more supportive of the expected payment approach. Now, with regards to the proposals to narrow the scope of application, as described in paragraph 36 of the staff paper, I think this is a really important aspect. In fact, I think these proposals to narrow the scope are quite a good idea, as I think it would help substantially with some of the practical application issues that have been raised by respondents. Looking at the two options described in paragraph 36 of the paper, I think, you know, the latter option is going to be of limited help, because I would assume, you know, that the materiality assessment is made in relation to the transaction. And so if you have a leaseback of, say, 10 or 20 years, my sense is that there would likely be a material difference in many, if not most, transactions. So my concern is that, you know, this latter option maybe wouldn't help that much. However, I think the first option that is proposed by the staff, you know, to narrow the scope, which is to apply the new requirements only to sale-leaseback transactions with variable payments linked to future performance or use, that to me definitely seems like a good suggestion, as my sense is that, you know, this is going to solve the main issue and would give quite a bit of practical relief. I wonder whether the board could even go one step further to further reduce complexity. That is, you know, when there's a sale-leaseback with variable payments linked to future performance or use, to only require estimation of expected payments that are linked to future performance or use, rather than to all expected payments, including variable payments that are linked to an index or rate. Now, with regards to the main alternative solutions suggested by respondents, I do agree with respondents that those seem, you know, a more pragmatic solution, especially as compared to the original proposals in the exposure draft, you know, without the scope narrowing, for what is intended as a temporary fix, pending a more holistic analysis as part of the IFRS 16 PIR. On the other hand, I also think that respondents' concerns are likely to be mitigated to some extent by the proposals of the staff to narrow the scope. So I think these staff proposals are really quite helpful with regards to the narrowing of the scope. Now, with respect to the deferred gain approach, I certainly understand why the staff is not proposing to proceed with this option, as this would touch the initial measurement of the right of use asset, and so it would seem to me move the project outside of the board's intended boundary. I have to say, personally, I actually do have quite a bit of sympathy for the deferred gain approach. So if the board is inclined not to touch the initial measurement of the right of use asset at this time, my sense is that the deferred gain approach may be something worth exploring further as part of the IFRS 16 PIR. In relation to the componentized liability approach, I'd like to point out that this approach seems to result in a, you know, similar accounting as the deferred gain approach. Particularly, my understanding is that the net impact on P&L would be the same under both approaches. So I think some of the concerns are mainly in relation to, you know, presentation in the income statement. I do understand, however, you know, the concerns of the staff from a conceptual point of view, especially around presentation within P&L. So whilst I can see that this approach has some merits from a practical point of view, and would seem to achieve a similar accounting as the deferred gain approach. I acknowledge that this approach has some conceptual weaknesses, as pointed out by the staff, and definitely raises some issues around presentation within P&L. So in summary, as a long-term solution to the issue, I do have quite a bit of sympathy for the deferred gain approach, as I think it can appropriately address the issue of gain deferral, you know, without creating complexity. However, you know, since this approach would involve a modification of the current requirements around the initial measurement of the right of use asset, I understand that this would move the project outside of the board's intended boundaries at this point in time. So since this is intended as an interim solution that focuses on the subsequent measurement of the liability only, and the board is inclined not to touch the initial measurement of the right of use asset at this time, I understand why the staff is not proposing to go ahead with the deferred gain approach at this time. So on this basis, my recommendation would be to go ahead with the expected payments approach as a short-term solution pending the IFRS 16 PIR, and combine this with the practical relief by narrowing down the scope, such that the new requirements would only apply to sale-leaseback transactions with variable payments linked to future performance or use. So I think as a longer-term solution, I feel that the deferred gain approach might be something worth further exploring. But in the short term, that's my recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carsten. Can I ask you a question? That your references to deferred gain make me sit up straight. So in IFRS 16 at the moment, the model, as you know, for sale and leasebacks is to limit the amount of gain recognition to the extent that there's been a transfer of rights, for want of a better explanation, to the purchaser.
Yeah.
So are you saying that we should reconsider that idea? Because clearly, to me, the feedback that we got that suggested the sort of deferred gain approach and then resulted in, you know, a gain coming in over time would over the term of the leaseback result in the full gain potentially being recognised in P&L. So are you saying that's better? So are you questioning the limitation on the gain, which is sort of the anchor we've got at the moment?
No, not at all. I think gain recognition should be restricted at the point in time where the transaction occurs. I definitely agree with that notion. But my understanding was that under the deferred gain approach, you would still limit gain recognition and defer, let's say, the deferred gain. You would amortize the deferred gain over the term of the leaseback. That's my understanding of the deferred gain approach.
Yes, whereas with sale and leaseback accounting, generally over the term of the sale and leaseback, that portion of the gain that's associated with the right of use is not recognised at all. Whereas I think the deferred gain approach limits the recognition on day one, but it brings in the gain over the term of the leaseback, which is quite different to the normal sale and leaseback accounting. So are you suggesting we should think about that?
Well, under the current requirements, you would still recognize a gain in relation to the rights that you have transferred. So it's only the portion that you have retained, right? That's what you're talking about, Sue, I assume, right? So for the portion that you have retained, whether you would amortize the gain, is that?
Yeah, I think that's what Sue's getting at, that under the deferred gain approach, Carsten, as you show, like, if I look at the numbers on page 31, the 200 of the gain that's deferred at the start, because you've only recognised 600, you know, at the date of the transaction, the 200 of the overall gain and sale flows through as a credit to P&L over the lease term. So I think that's what Sue's getting at, is that under a deferred gain approach, that 200 effectively throws through as a credit to the P&L, whereas under the model we've developed in IFRS 16, there is no sort of credit that flows through over the lease term. You might say overall, of course, by the end of the lease term, everything's in the same place, but it's quite different because the way it flows through in the model we've got is you're not uplifting the value of the right of use effect. It's an effect carried at historical cost, so your depreciation charge, you know, is lower. So there's no notion of releasing a deferred gain under our current model.
Yeah, no, I understand. Personally, I wouldn't be uncomfortable with, you know, recognizing that deferred gain over time, because as you said, implicitly, well, you don't have that liability sitting on your balance sheet as a deferred gain under the traditional model, let's say. But implicitly, obviously, you know, once the leaseback ends, you know, everything ends up in P&L, right? So I think it would just simplify the accounting. That's with a reasonable outcome. Therefore, I think for the longer term, I think that may be an option further considering. But I agree that, you know, given what you described in the paper on the project boundaries, that's maybe something for the PIR to consider.
Okay, thanks, Kirsten. John, I think you were next.
Okay, I'm going to follow approach that Jens followed and start with question B on the narrowing of the scope. In my view, I wouldn't narrow the scope beyond through the discussion that you and Jens had of maybe leveraging the wording in paragraph 27 and 28 of IFRS 16 on the variable lease payments that are dependent on index rate. But I wouldn't go beyond that because I think, as noted in the paper and consistent with my experience, sale leaseback transactions are structured. They're very bespoke. They're rather one-off in nature. And I think if you introduce exceptions that go beyond the linking of to an index or a rate and limit it to the participation of the cash flows of the underlying asset, you're creating a structuring opportunity whereby somewhat similar transactions for, say, a leaseback could be presented rather differently in the financial statement. So I wouldn't go beyond the existing variable lease considerations that you have in paragraphs 27 and 28. Of IFRS 16, and so my recommendation would be not to further the scope to answer question B. Moving to question A, to me the expected payment approach makes a lot of sense, and perhaps this is because of my own experiences with my own companies or my own employer. I can't imagine bringing a transaction like this to, say, a leaseback transaction to a governance process in a company and not having a clear expectation of when the cash flows would happen. Because, you know, in order to be confident that the consideration paid for the sale leaseback transaction is appropriate and reasonable, I think the parties would need to have a valid expectation of what is the timing of cash flows, what are the expected overall amount of cash flows, and what are the risks associated with the possible variability in those cash flows. So I think it would be typical, given the structured nature of these transactions, to have an expectation, and therefore to have the accounting reflect that, to me makes a lot of sense. I guess, I was thinking about a comment that Dane made about perhaps, and also I think Jens, about, you know, following more of an IFRS 9 approach of modifying the accounting and revisiting the accounting as the expectations were to change, because inevitably they will. If there's any sort of variability, estimates will change. I think, to me, that goes a step further, because I think I like the idea of limiting, let's say, formal reconsideration of the accounting to the types of modification that's already expressed in IFRS 16, and not requiring a more systematic reconsideration of the cash flows. And to me, it makes sense that any noise, let's say, between the difference between your expectations and the actual cash flows flow through as a lease payment, that makes sense to me. It should affect, in my view, operating income. It should not flow through to the financing income. And again, that might be reflective of the industries and the companies that I've worked with in the past. But to me, it makes sense that the variability flows through the operating result and not as a financing cost. So with that, I would say that, again, the expected payments approach, as summarized by the staff, makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that it would be a reasonable approach.
Okay, thank you, John. Guy.
Thanks. I'll start in the order in the paper of the questions rather than in the reverse order on the scoping question first. But I guess when I reflect on the alternatives proposed, the alternative in the ED, the imputed payments alternative to that, and then also the alternatives presented in Appendix B to the paper that, that came through the comment letters, I have to admit, I find it rather difficult to pick a clear winner out of those various models. Maybe if I'll perhaps set aside the deferred gain model in Appendix B first, given the additional variation in that model relative to paragraph 100A in IFRS 16 and the current concerns about, you know, that re-exploring that as part of this fill the gap effort currently is perhaps a step too far at this point. And so maybe I'll focus first on expected payments, imputed payments, and the componentized liability approach. If I'm understanding these models correctly, you know, I think it's fair to say the starting point in all the models is rather similar. Yes, there may be you know, more mechanical specification in that starting point in the expected payments proposal, but, you know, setting that aside, the starting point is essentially the same. And the differences between the model are to me all about how the liability then subsequently unwinds. And it's in that respect that I find it very difficult to say, you know, one model is clearly better than the other model, because none of the models are conceptually perfect. They're all sort of a practical type mechanical solution to something that just doesn't really fit precisely, you know, recognizing our approach to carrying value day one, and simplifications with regard to, you know, not requiring remeasurement on an ongoing basis. So the expected payments and imputed payments models, you know, have the advantage of embedding, you know, an interest charge for, you know, the at least the initial variable payments portion of the liability, unlike perhaps the componentized liability model. But you know, there's lots of other noise in those models. There's no remeasurement, and if there is potential for those expected payments to change significantly, you know, that's by far not a perfect model either. The imputed payments model, you know, having this level payments profile embedded in the modeling day one, you know, in some circumstances can just be arbitrary, and perhaps no better than just a straight line runoff of that componentized liability element in the componentized liability approach in Appendix B. And so, I think we can sort of pick flaws or pick benefits in each of the models, you know, and it's a trade-off, you know, between simplicity, understandability, complexity, et cetera, et cetera. But none of them are perfect. And so, you know, the thought that's going through my head is, you know, should we mandate, you know, one model for everything, given the imperfections in each of those proposals? And, you know, is there a way to, you know, move forward with some degree of flexibility in how entities are going to approach the runoff of the liability? And, you know, I think it is helpful to articulate the different types of mechanical approaches that one might consider: the expected payments approach, the imputed payments approach, the componentized liability approach. But, you know, do we really need to specify that in all cases thou shalt follow, you know, model A, and you can never follow model B or model C? The important question here is, well, we've established that the initial accounting, you can't book the gain, and then as a consequence, that raises mechanical issues on how the liability should run off in subsequent measurement. But none of those approaches are perfect. And so, do we really want to mandate or specify one as opposed to maybe illustrate alternatives and possible, you know, approaches that entities can consider based on their own facts and circumstances on how to approach that? Because again, I find it difficult to pick a preferable model. If If I was told, no, guy, you got to pick one. None of them are perfect, but we got to pick one. We have to have one. I probably, if pressed, have to sort of acknowledge that it may be expected payments has maybe more conceptual basis. But again, it's not a perfect model either. So I think maybe there might be some merit in considering whether there is a way of illustrating approaches but not mandating one particular approach. On the moving to the scoping questions, I think on the scoping questions, they each raise additional mechanical complexity on how to marry initial measurement and then subsequent measurement. But setting aside how to solve some of those mechanical questions for a moment, I think there is some benefit in trying to narrow the scope of this. I kind of like the idea of focusing on variable payments that are not dependent on an index or rate, largely because it was those that the whole issue and debate started with. And
Guy, yeah. Can I put you on hold for a minute? I just had a message from Sue that they've in the boardroom lost connection. So I think just wants us to hold for a minute until they can get back online.
Okay.
Sorry, because you were in mid-flow of a really interesting thought.
We're just trying to reconnect. Sorry, guys. Guy, can you try speaking? We'll see if we can hear you.
Can you hear me now, Sue?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Sorry, everybody. We lost connection here, and you guys obviously could still hear each other. I could see you on my laptop, but not on the main screen, which is particularly frustrating. Thank you, Simon. So Guy, sorry for that. I just heard you say that you liked the flexibility, but if you were pushed, you would prefer the expected payments method. Can I ask you to try and gather your train of thought from there, if that's all right? Sorry.
Sure. So I think after I made that comment, I was moving on to the second question about narrowing the population, and I was starting to say that I think inevitably when we move to narrow the population, it does raise other mechanical questions on how to marry initial and subsequent measurement an entity would need to sort of work through the mechanics of and try to solve in some way. But setting that aside, having said that, I was starting to say that I think the issue that we've debated here really emanated from variable payments that were not dependent on an index or rate. And sort of sticking to that population seems to have merit rather than expanding that population. So I think I would be in favor of further exploring that narrowing as proposed in the paper. On the narrowing based on materiality, I wasn't entirely clear on what was being proposed there. My suspicion is we would be suggesting something perhaps along the lines of, well, if the variable payments other than those based on an index or rate are expected to be an insignificant portion of the overall lease payments, then we're not going to, that's not subject to these proposals. And, you know, one might say, well, OK, what's the point of that? If that were true, you could ignore the proposals anyway on sort of materiality grounds. And so it's kind of unnecessary. But I guess to the extent you have more than one sale leaseback, that could be helpful in terms of providing some relief from having to consider the aggregate effects of more than one transaction and thinking through materiality, et cetera. So, you know, even though the benefit of that may be more narrow, more limited, you know, I wasn't adverse to exploring that that narrowing as well. And so I think on both fronts, there's probably some merit in taking a closer look at means of considering those narrowing of scope proposals. But I'll stop there, Sue.
Thank you, Guy. That's helpful, and sorry for the break in the middle. Mary, were you coming in to make an observation specifically on Guy, or were you just making an observation at the end of the queue?
If you don't mind, it was very much prompted by Guy's thinking, and if I can piggyback on that, that'd be great.
Yep.
Apologies to the others. Guy, when I was reading the paper, I had an additional thought that it is not the same as yours, but it, you know, is similar to yours, which is if the committee members were reinforcing the messages we heard in the comment letters about the expected payments being fundamentally too inconsistent with the basic lease model and subject to very high degrees of measurement uncertainty, then we shouldn't pursue it. Then what should we do? I'm going to observe first that it's interesting to hear so many of the committee members who've spoken so far looking at the expected payment model that was the basis in the ED and the basis for the ED, and also pushing back on assertions that you wouldn't be able to do the estimation. But if overall we decide that is compelling in terms of not changing the accounting, I find it important to hear from committee members that you think that the gap should be plugged. And I wonder if the way to plug the gap would be, like Guy's suggestion, less specific, but maybe not as flexible as his approach. And what I was wondering is if we just went back to the core principle of the core principle of the sale leaseback requirements, which is to say, if you sell something and lease back a portion, then to the extent that you really never transfer the portion that you lease back, you do not have any gain recognized. You are not stepping up that lease back piece. And you know, the IFRS 16 sale leaseback discussion focuses on day one, and what the committee's discussion has highlighted is, and we're trying to plug the gap so it doesn't happen on day two or day three either, particularly if somebody inserts a modification to move it, you know, to, in theory, move it out of the day one prohibition and into ongoing normal variable lease payment subsequent accounting. And I wondered if we should just move to saying, okay, we were trying to get consistency, comparability in how you both measured the proportion retained, and then that provided a basis for doing the subsequent accounting using an expected value approach. If we just step back and say, if that's too complicated, we're just going to confirm in our standard setting that the day one prohibition continues throughout the life of the leaseback arrangement. And I'm not talking about subject to modifications. I'm just saying, as long as you retain a portion of that which you have sold and sold, then the prohibition on gain recognition continues for the duration of that leaseback. And then not specify how you do the calculation. If we didn't specify, Guy, to your point, how you're supposed to do the calculation, then I think it might be hard to justify using the expected payment approach, because that's inconsistent with the principles that say do not include variable lease payments in your measurement of the lease liability. I think we need standard setting to support using that mechanism, but it would allow other reasonable mechanisms that achieve the objective of not doing an end run around the day one prohibition. And I guess, Sue, the last thing I wanted to point out is to ask people to think about is that although IFRS 16 is specific, really only in respect of day one, do not recognize a gain for the piece that you lease back. It doesn't set it up as a deferred gain that it's okay to bring it in over the period. It just says do not recognize that. And so when I looked at this paper, and I think it's in the appendix, I think it's B10, it makes the point that the mechanisms that some people have suggested achieve not only recognizing the gain that is kind of characterized as, quote, deferred, but in some cases, additional amounts. And that, to me, is inconsistent with the basic principle of the sale-leaseback section of IFRS 16. So, Guy, that's a different take on your don't specify the method, maybe not as flexible, but just focuses the standard setting on the basic requirement.
So if I was to paraphrase your idea partly, Mary, in case others want to comment on it when they come in, it would almost be saying, look, the key thing that we wanted to address when the question came to the committee in the first place was the gain recognition aspect of things, where we have this tension with the definition of a lease payment. We addressed that with the agenda decision confirming the sort of moment one accounting, if you like, on the sale and lease back. We could then just say, okay, confirming the over the life gain restriction. We could just say that. And given the small, I think we still think it's a few large transactions, but not that common, but they matter when they happen. Given that, should we rather not go any further in terms of specifying the mechanics, knowing that means that people might do slightly different things, working with the words that they've got to work within. But given cost benefit of the complexity of this area, would that be a better overall assessment and approach than really getting into the mechanics in such detail, which all of these approaches are doing? I think in short would be sort of the outcome of your approach. So just for people to think about. Okay, thanks, Mary. Paul, I think you were next.
Thanks, Sue. I guess I'm compelled to start with an observation which kind of follows on some of the things Mary was saying, which is the root cause of the issue is the fact that the board employs a partial sale model for sale leasebacks, notwithstanding the fact that the analysis begins by going to IFRS 15 to determine if there was a sale, and IFRS 15 does not have a partial sale notion in it. So I think one of the things the board will probably want to think about during post-implementation review is whether to retain partial sale model for sale leaseback, recognizing that that is going to create some practice problems because of the inherent tensions that creates, or whether an alternative approach might be to provide additional guidance in determining whether a sale has occurred in the first place through the lens of IFRS 15. But I acknowledge those are issues for post-implementation review. So taking as a given that there is the partial sale model in IFRS 16, the next point that resonates with me is very similar to the one that John made earlier, which is unlike, to use air quotes, regular leases where lessees can literally have hundreds of leases that might have variable payments in them. In my experience, sale leaseback transactions are one-off. They are highly structured to achieve an economic outcome that is very carefully negotiated between the seller lessee and the buyer lessor. And as a consequence of that, the arguments about complexity of the accounting, frankly, ring hollow with me, because it is not the accounting that's creating complexity, but rather it is the complexity of the sale leaseback arrangement that is the issue at play here. And as with John, I am highly skeptical that a seller lessee enters into a significant sale leaseback arrangement without some understanding of what the expected cash flows are going to be coming out of that. That doesn't seem to me to be a an approach that has adequate controls around approving transactions, and I think it raises governance questions. So if we begin with a presumption that we have a company that does have controls and a an appropriate governance structure, I think it is very likely that they also have expectations about the future cash flows. And so that, in terms of the model, tells me that the expected payment approach is the one, again, caveated with the fact that we've got a partial sale model here, is the one that is most representative of the expected economics coming out of the arrangement on the part of the seller lessee. Conversely, the imputed payment approach appears to me to introduce artificial volatility, that is, more volatility than is actually anticipated by the seller lessee when it entered into the transaction. Deferred gain approach has the issues that I think Mary raised, and to a certain extent Karsten raised as well, so that doesn't seem like a viable approach. And componentizing the liability seems like an artificial complexity that isn't warranted. So I would end up in the expected payment approach without remeasurement for the same reasons that John explained. And in terms of calls that the board has received and would inevitably continue to receive about complexity, my response would be it's the complexity of the arrangement that is what is at play here, rather than the complexity of the accounting. Turning to scope, again, similar to what John said, I really worry about narrowing the scope from what is in the exposure draft, because that runs a significant risk of accounting arbitrage with arrangements that might be highly similar but not exactly the same, ending up with some significantly different accounting. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Paul. Brian.
Thank you, Sue. So I will try to answer the questions in the order they're in the paper and then make a general observation. So if I start with expected versus imputed, and I think Paul has said this very nicely, and I think there's a theme running through the board discussions and today's discussions, and it's captured in paragraph 10 of the agenda paper, that these transactions are highly structured and therefore seller lessee will have some kind of expectation as to what will happen in the future. But I think it's possible to reconcile that with the concerns in a lot of the comment letters about management uncertainty. Now, I can still have an expectation, but realize that it's subject to significant uncertainty. In my experience, there are some sale and leaseback deals where the seller lessee has an expectation, and it's a very precise expectation as to what the future cash flows will be. Now, if the underlying asset is something like a wind farm or a solar farm, and you've got lots of climate data, you can be very precise about what the payments under the leaseback are going to be. If the underlying asset is, I don't know, a retail store, and the rentals are going to vary with sales, or they're going to vary with CPI over a very long period in a high inflation economy, I imagine what the seller lessee has when it's negotiating and taking the deal past those charged with governance is they'll have a base case, and they'll have an upside case and a downside case and a dramatic downside and a catastrophic downside. Now, and they'll have a view, and they'll also have an understanding that might not come to pass. And very often in my experience, the reason that somebody, a seller lessee, is willing to accept that variability is that the chosen variability in the lease payments provides them with some kind of natural hedge against their income. I mean, I think that's obvious if you take the example of a retailer paying a rent that depends on its turnover, or a retailer paying a rent based on CPI, or a regulated industry whose income is explicitly linked to CPI. So I have a lot more concern, I think, about measurement uncertainty than I've heard in the discussion up to now. And that does make me pause about necessarily jumping for the expected payments approach. The version of the imputed payments approach in the paper I don't particularly like, because it forces imputation of a straight line set of cash flows. And if I look at the table on page 14 of the agenda paper, that imputed payments, because in fact the seller lessee probably expects that the payments will increase over time, forcing a straight line imputed payment results in positive variable lease expense in the early years of the lease and negative lease expense in the later years of the lease. And I don't think that's an attractive outcome at all. But I'm not sure that I want to tie entities or indeed auditors into going with something that is absolutely the expected cash flow. I would probably be closer to a version of the imputed approach that isn't, you know, that doesn't have the straight line constraint on it. It's a pattern of cash flows that those entering into the deal expect to be the pattern, but is not held out to be an incredibly precise expected set of cash flows. If I move on to the scope of the proposals, in common with just on remeasurement, because I think remeasurement is a very interesting idea. The thing I'd say about remeasurement, though, is these leasebacks will very often contain renewal options or purchase options, which are subject to very specific guidance in IFRS 16 on reassessment. So if there was going to be remeasurement for changes in the cash flows, you'd have to think through how that would interact with changes in the lease term driven by reassessment of lease term and purchase options, and whether you wanted to have one approach to variability within the lease term and a different approach to variability dealing with purchase and renewal options. But if I go on to the scope of the proposals, as a number of people have said, I think it's quite useful actually to build on the existing discussion of variability in IFRS 16 and take outside the scope of these proposals leasebacks where the only form of variability is variability based on an index or a rate, because that boundary is already applied in practice. And I think there are lots of sell and lease back transactions today, particularly in the retail sector, where the lease payments do vary with CPI, and I'm not aware that that's seen as a current practice issue, that variability based on CPI. And as the agenda paper notes, there is already guidance on subsequent measurement if that's the only form of variability. I don't like a materiality-based approach. I would like materiality to always be a financial statement-level concept rather than something that is worked through at a transaction level. So those are the questions in the paper. Just generally, I have a lot of sympathy for what I heard Mary say, building on Guy's contribution, about just how precise the board should be about these requirements, given that the goal is to have an interim solution that stops people booking gains on rights that they still control through to to the lease back. So I would certainly be happy doing the minimum that it was possible to do to achieve that goal. And that might be through a model like the one in the paper that's pitched somewhere between the expected and imputed cash flows, taking off the table transactions where the variability is not, you know, is due only to changes in index or a rate, or as I think you were saying, Sue, in answer to Mary's contribution, it might even just be a statement that you can't just take the income, this amount that people loosely refer to as deferred gain, but isn't a deferred gain, is just a consequence of the emission measurements of the right of use asset. And if I think about all of the questions I get about variable payments, you know, this is just a subset of them, and I expect there will be lots and lots of points about variable payments and the boundary variable versus fixed that will come out of the PIR. So, you know, doing the least possible to achieve the overriding objective right now would get my vote. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Karen?
I don't want to be repetitive, but as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, several companies changed from fixed lease payments to variable lease payments. Although I really like the theoretical aspect of expected approach, and I also like the narrowing the scope, I think it's the correct way to pursue. I'm concerned about this change that we see in the market, since a lot of companies change to variable payments because that's the only way to survive in the pandemic times. And also, when I don't remember it was Guy that was speaking about the cash flows, I'm concerned about that also. Because when you are talking about companies that are not dealing with US dollar as a functional currency, the only certainty that we have is that we are not going to match the cash flow to actual numbers, but we are going to be by far away from the numbers that we estimate. So I have these concerns that I'd like to share with the group. But reading the documents that were prepared, I really like the expected approach and narrowing the scope, but I think we are going to hit much more companies than we are thinking because of this change in the market. Thank you. So,
thank you, Renata. Karen?
Thank you. So the issue really arises because we don't have variable payments incorporated in the IFRS 16 model. And then when we get to a sale leaseback, we have to figure out how to comply with paragraph 100A and figure out how to, as Mary said, make sure that that gain isn't recognized on day one and also it's not recognized on day two. And so, you know, we have this awkward problem to fix, an exception to make. I think someone mentioned hammering a square peg into a round hole. And so I do have some more sympathy for a simpler option. I think trying to find a conceptually pure option where we're working with the fact that we're building an exception to a model in a short term is probably a very challenging objective. And I think as some others have mentioned, there's technical or conceptual flaws or simplifications we're proposing in each model. We're not going to remeasure and so on. So I wasn't convinced that the next stage should only focus on the two approaches recommended by staff. Because I think I was still in my own mind trying to figure out, are we trying to solve the how to prevent the gain from being recognized, what we're really trying to say, we really want to find a measurement model for this difference, and that needs to be a financial liability measurement model. And so I wasn't as married, and I am a financial instrument person, so the fact that the only solution was to try to fit this into a financial instrument model and impute interest on it and so on. So I have a bit more, I guess, sympathy for trying to find the path to the most practical way to give people a solution to what's now known to be a problem. I do struggle with the deferred gain because I think given that you're not remeasuring the right of use asset, that seems to be the one that doesn't fit at all. And I would put that one off to the side, but I didn't totally agree with completely discounting the componentized liability element. I think there's some merits to that. And then, you know, Mary's comments, I was thinking through that, you know, sometimes less is more, especially if it is a temporary fix and trying to just find a way to bridge this gap that's currently there. So I would certainly recommend, and I can understand that of all the options, the one that's easiest to think through conceptually is the expected payments. But I would encourage thinking more broadly about what are we trying to do and how long will this last, and is there a more practical solution, as Mary was talking about. Which means I think that componentized liability or even a different option should still be on the table. And obviously during the IFRS 16 PIR, you know, the broader question of how to deal with variable payments should be in play. On question two, I do have some sympathy for narrowing it to just the specific payments that are linked to performance. That was the original question. That is the one that I think is possibly more complex. I'm not as certain as some other people that these are always easy to estimate, and that there isn't a degree of optimism sometimes in how those numbers are estimated. So I would be fine to narrow the scope. I wasn't as comfortable with adding in a materiality concept. I think, as one of the other members said, materiality is a concept that underlies all the decisions about whether you apply aspects of a standard. Baking it into a standard, I think, just makes it confusing about how do you apply materiality to a part of a standard that incorporates materiality directly. It's should be a principle that underlies that all. So I think that I would like to keep a few more options open and not just settle on the expected payments as the sole path forward. Those are my thoughts.
Okay, thank you, Karen. Goro.
Thank you very much, Sue. I have to confess that this agenda paper is the most technically difficult one to me and then find a position to evaluate which measurement approach is better one. But I found is that the like guys, I thought that the no measurement approach proposed are perfect. So that from user's point of view, I find that probably if the board pick up the it might be very difficult for the financial statement user to, you know, understand the economic substance of the this quite complex transaction with sales and lease back with a variable lease payment. And so from the user's point of view, so my favorite approach, which had not been discussed yet, is that the include provision of relevant information in the financial statement and notes to be extremely useful for the financial statement users, even compared to the information provided by the new measurement requirement for the sale and lease back liability. I think that useful information for users would include the outstanding amount of sale and lease back liability separately presented on the sale of the underlying asset at the initial recognition and the variable lease payment arising from the sale and lease back liability during the current period also separately present in the PL. And also disclosures in the notes, including the explanations about the sale and lease back contract and the objective and the reason to use variable lease payment for the transaction. And as this kind of transaction, that my concern that is that this kind of transaction could be used for the accounting arbitrage. So that the reason why that the preparers are using such a complex transaction is very important. And also, how the company measures the sale and lease back liability and the limitation of the measurement approach they adopted. I believe such improved presentation and disclosures would call for the financial statement users' attention on the transaction and end users and the preparers. I believe this is a much more cost-effective way to address the problem. Of course, that said, I admit this is not the fundamental solution to the measurement problem, the sale and leaseback liability. Therefore, I encourage the board to consider the development of the measurement requirement during the PIR of the IFRS 16, instead of pursuing just an interim solution now. And I have a question to suggest an interim solution. Therefore, should we expect that the much more full-scale discussion on this matter during the PIR of IFR 16? And if so, my concern is that there might be a quite frequent change of this kind of transaction between accounting is quite difficult for financial statement users to understand. Therefore, that the frequent change in possible resulting frequent change in the measurement could be quite onerous for the financial statement users to understand the accounting for these kind of transactions. And I think that such a frequent change in the measurement could also be quite onerous view. I'm not sure that my comment is relevant to this question, but from the financial statement users, I sense that we should also discuss about the possible presentation and the disclosure with that measurement. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Goran. And I think your comment is relevant because ultimately the board, by putting out the exposure draft and in the re-deliberations, is having to assess the necessity or otherwise of doing something in the near term with a view to looking at potentially sale and leasebacks more comprehensively later on. So I think your point is well made. So thank you for that.
And if it is helpful, I think, to feed into what you said, Goro, it was very much in the board's mind and thinking about, you know, the information provided to investors, even in the proposals in the exposure draft. So rather than have at an interim phase really change and then possible more change, that's why they very much sort of scope this narrowly, to just fill a gap, not to actually propose really change to how the sale and leaseback transactions are accounted for, but just try to fill where there might be some missing requirements.
Yeah, but we need to think carefully, you're right. Okay, Jim, sorry, people are waiting a long time, but we'll get to you, Jim.
All right, thank you, Sue. And I think it's a well-written paper, and which triggered all these concerns and questions just as we just talked about. And most importantly, this paper pointed out the issue very specifically and clearly. And I did a little bit of research on this, and fortunately, it's this kind of arrangement, lease arrangement, it's yet seen in my part of the world. And even better, I don't expect to see this much in the near future. But after saying that, just reading through the paper, I share many of these concerns and thoughts we just mentioned here, so I won't repeat. Just like Guy mentioned, if we have to pick one, and the expected payment approach seems more reasonable. But right after Guy's just a comment, Mary, I think, gave us a much better way out, which is a more general principle-based guidelines than these two or many other specific calculations or mechanics. So I think if we go with the more general approach, it should satisfy the current issue, which is a bigger picture here, to solve the moment one to the end of this arrangement. So I like Mary's suggestion or observation the best. But in terms of this, the scoping, I think if we're going to settle the approach first, if we go with a more generic, the scoping shouldn't be a problem. And if we have to give a specific guideline or even a calculation or detailed mechanism, so we should go with a narrower approach in terms of scoping. But we should test, or we could wait for the approach and then test the market for the scoping. That's my thoughts.
Thank you, Jim. Andre, your first opportunity to speak at the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue. I'd just say that maybe my starting position is that I'm reluctant to have the difference between the lease liability measurement, including variable lease payments, and the between a sale and lease back transaction and a regular lease transaction. So therefore, I'm more in favor of either the componentized or the deferred gain approach, recognizing that the deferred gain approach may cross a bright line in terms of, you know, releasing into the income statement something related to you know, that we're going to label again, and therefore may require kind of broader rethinking and then acceptance of that rethinking by both the board and constituents. But for me, you know, Carsten in his contribution mentioned that, you know, it could pose a presentation issue. For me, in a very real sense, it poses a presentation advantage because in my view, the holding gain that is not recognized fully upon the sale, and as Paul mentioned, you know, we do make reference to IFRS 15 to understand if the sale is a completed sale. For me, it does maybe give, you know, it raises the interesting question of, you know, even if we do think that we should only partially recognize the gain at inception, you know, isn't it appropriate at some point in time for that gain to impact income, whether it's called out as a gain or embedded in one of the other measurement attributes, you know, of the right of use, for example. So that's why, for me, the componentized approach maybe isn't the worst outcome, because it preserves the lease liability at its kind of standard IFRS 16 measurement approach without introducing a difference between the standard model, without introducing additional components into the lease liability that aren't eligible for initial recognition otherwise, while at the same time using the same measurement approach for the right of use asset. But I would echo the comments from Carsten that the deferred gain approach could come back up as an alternative in future deliberations. I do have some, you know, as I said, my hesitation about including payments in the expected payment approach or the imputed payment approach, which would not qualify for recognition as part of the liability under a standard model, really give me pause. And I would agree with Guy's position that there is, you know, each of the approaches have kind of advantages and disadvantages. So my sense is that, you know, maybe the componentized approach or a variant of it is useful.
Okay, thank you very much. BJ, last but not least.
Yeah. Thanks. Within the project boundary and the approach for an interim solution, with the objective of restricting the gains on sale and lease back, which we actually see it as a financing transaction, I am empathetic towards the expected payments approach. However, imputed payments approach, in my view, is not a bad method. It is simpler. It is in particular useful when we have sale and lease back transactions in situations like an asset has a residual life of 20 years, but I take a lease back for 5 years. So those situations. Or there's a campus which has 4 towers which are identical. I take 1 tower back on lease. So those kind of situations, measuring the proportion of asset which you're retaining, it's a little easier one. Hence, as a fill-in-the-gap approach and pending PR, I am open, as Guy was also mentioning, a solution of enabling imputed payments method as well, instead of restricting it only to expected payments method. I do agree that sale and lease back transactions are all structured, well negotiated, and lessees have an idea of the expected cash flows or payments. But given the fact that we have this fundamental understanding that there is a measurement uncertainty when it comes to variable payments, and also the fact that we are not permitting subsequent remeasurement in the case of expected payments method, the imputed payments method is simpler for users to understand. It's fairly simpler in my view. So my view, as far as the long term is concerned, maybe none of the 4 methods might eventually be the solution after the PR is done. I somehow have a strong feeling that a solution will emerge which will be a bit of all of these and it will be quite different. Given that backdrop, I think if there is an option, given the observation in the staff analysis of Para 19, that they have, in that AlphaSense kind of a desktop review, there are hardly any transactions which have come up. And the fact that the PR is not too far away, can we live with this problem of keeping it open now rather than prescribing approach and then going through one more change which may actually confuse the investors? That's my thoughts on question A. As far as B is concerned, my view is that we should not have a restriction in the scope. Because having restriction in scope, it would probably encourage a bit of structuring. But if we are proceeding in the direction of having a restriction scope, I would rather prefer restriction based on the materiality criterion, which is the second option which is there. These are my thoughts.
Thank you very much, BJ. Sorry the wait was so long. That was a really good discussion. I think you've raised lots of really useful points for us to think about. I'm not sure I know what the punchline is, but lots for us to think about. So thank you, everybody, for your comments today. I'm hoping nobody's left outstanding because I've lost connection for the 4th time during this meeting, so I have no chat at the moment. I think I've covered everybody. Nobody's screaming or twitching, so that's good. So that brings today's meeting to a close. A really good discussion, as always. So thank you very much to everybody for your contributions. So we're going to reconvene for part 2 tomorrow, same time as we started today, so 12:30 UK time. So I look forward to seeing everybody then. Thank you very much.